Deutsche Welle Africa Link.
Hello and welcome to the show. Happy to be with you again here at Africa Link. My name is Assumpta Latos. French and Malian forces recapture northern Malian cities with little resistance.
The French strategic gains over Timbuktu as well as Gao clearly are a positive indication of the operations thus far, but I don't think that we should overstate the victory as of yet.
A visually impaired Ghanaian lawyer has been nominated for a top job in the government.
All along, I've believed that disability is not a barrier. Most of the time, people meet somebody who is disabled, they start off the assumption that you cannot do it, which is wrong.
And we will also be covering a $10 billion silicon savanna to be built in Kenya. Stay with us.
Top story.
We kick off with Mali. African and Western countries meeting in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa have pledged some 340 million euros in aid for Mali. The crisis in the Western African state, where French troops are spearheading efforts to dislodge Islamist militants, overshadowed an African Union summit which preceded the donors' conference. This report by Ludka Shadomsky is presented for Africa Link by Susan Holton.
As in previous years, Africa's trouble spots dominated this AU conference, which was chaired for the first time by the new head of the AU Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. Delegates say she ran the conference with discipline and efficiency and was very well informed. The crises in Mali, the DRC and Sudan were debated in the plenary sessions and in the corridors of the towering Chinese-built new AU headquarters. African heads of government are not used to being rebuked in public by their peers. They were therefore surprised when the outgoing AU chairman, President Thomas Yayi Boni of Benin, scolded them for failing to come to the aid of Mali faster. AU member nations have until the end of this week to decide on the forces they will contribute to the Africa-led support mission in Mali, known as AFISMA. Burundi and Tanzania have already said they will send in troops. At the weekend, defence ministers from countries belonging to the West African regional body ECOWAS said they would raise the number of soldiers taking part in AFISMA from 4,500 to 5,700. Chad, which is not a member of ECOWAS, has offered a further 2,000. Currently, almost all the African troops active in the battle zone are from Mali itself. Mahari Tadeli Maru, a political analyst in Addis Ababa, explains why.
Of course, this relates to the weakness of the African Union and the ECOWAS as institutions that could have prevented this kind of situation. So lack of political will is not a serious challenge. I think the financial aspect is much more acute now.
Solomon Ayeli Derso from the Institute for Security Studies in Addis Ababa favours the swift creation of an African standby force, which could help save time when responding to future crises.
At the summit, there has been a repeated reference to the need to fast-track the operationalization of the rapid deployment capability, which forms part of the African standby force, to be deployed into a conflict area within 14 days of the African Union Peace and Security Council mandating its deployment. And if that capability is put in place, there is definitely a possibility of African countries being able to respond more quickly than they did, as in the case of Mali.
The donors' conference was opened on Tuesday morning by Alassane Ouattara, president of Ivory Coast and chairman of ECOWAS. It was attended by African nations and 60 partner organizations and countries, including the United Nations and the European Commission, and its purpose was to secure funding for the Mali mission. Ouattara said that more than 700 million euros were needed, as well as 10,000 troops. The African Union has earmarked 40 million euros, Germany has promised 15 million, and the sum total of all pledges was 340 million euros. Analyst Derso says money alone won't be enough.
It is imperative that a political process is launched to address the crisis in Mali. The crisis in Mali is not just a security or a military crisis. It is also preeminently a political as well as a humanitarian crisis.
With such concerns evidently in mind, Mali's president, Diomkunda Traore, announced on Tuesday that he hopes to hold elections by July the 31st.
Susan Holton with that report by Ludka Shadonsky. Now, people are rejoicing that French-led troops in Mali now control the historically important city of Timbuktu and the city of Gao that was an Islamist stronghold for almost a year. But there are also fears that Islamist fighters could slip back any time as the soldiers advance, leaving those areas unguarded. I have been speaking to Kayla Brinson, intelligence analyst at the Risk Advisory Group based in Dubai, to find out if it is too early to say the Islamists have been beaten.
Well, it depends on what your definition of being beaten is. I mean, in terms of ousting the radical Islamists from the north fully, that certainly remains to be seen. The French strategic gains over Timbuktu as well as Gao clearly are a positive indication of the operations thus far, but I don't think that we should overstate the victory as of yet. These groups have been in control of the Northern Territory since the beginning of last year, and there's a great risk that they may try to embed themselves in the local population, given their long-standing time in the region.
What do you expect will be the Islamists' next move?
I do think that there's a great risk of retaliatory attacks. There's been a lack of direct confrontation with these Islamist groups during the recaptures of Gao and Timbuktu, which may be an indication that perhaps the operations have led the Islamist groups to retreat further north, particularly around the region of Kidal.
How well do the French and ECOWAS troops know their enemy?
The public statements from French officials seem to indicate that they might have underestimated the capabilities of these groups.
To what extent is the desert terrain helping the Islamists?
Based on current indications and our research, many of these groups, including the relatively native Ansar al-Din, that's dominated largely by Tuaregs, have a strong familiarity with the desert region. And it increases essentially the risk of a protracted conflict because they have such a strong familiarity and because even groups such as AQIM have been operating in the border areas for several years now, whether it's related to smuggling or other criminal activities in general. So there's very much so a strong familiarity with the region. And we can't really rule out kinship networks and support bases across the area as well. There have definitely been reports that some of these groups, not only do they have the native kin ties, such as Ansar al-Din, but that there have been intermarriages between the local population and these terrorist factions.
Kayla Brinson on the line there from Dubai.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Nigerian authorities have cautiously welcomed a ceasefire declaration by an alleged commander of the Islamist sect Boko Haram. The man told journalists in the northern city of Maiduguri that a ceasefire was imminent. The group is blamed for more than 700 deaths since it started its campaign against modern education and the current government in 2009. This is not the first time that Boko Haram claimed that they are about to implement a ceasefire. Why should people take this claim seriously? I put that question to our correspondent in Abuja, Ben Adam Shemang.
Well, this claim should be taken seriously by Nigerians because we are now talking of people who have been declared wanted by the soldiers. I'm talking of Abubakar Shekau himself. He is the leader of the deadly faction of Boko Haram. And his second in command, Sheikh Abu Mohammed Abdulaziz Ibn Idris, he has addressed the press and said they should be taken seriously and that they have also spoken with the governor of Borno State, who held a meeting with them.
The so-called Boko Haram commander says the group agreed that our brethren in Islam, both women and children, are suffering unnecessarily. Hence, we resolved that we should bring this crisis to an end. Is he speaking for the entire group or just one small faction?
He is definitely speaking for his own group, bearing in mind that Boko Haram is in factions. But this group is the largest of them all. This group is a serious one that should be taken seriously too by government.
He says their decision came after the government agreed to release some members of Boko Haram from prison. Has the government confirmed that they held closed doors negotiations with the group?
the federal government has not reacted categorically to these recent peace moves by Boko Haram. But we know in the past that the Minister of Information, Labaran Maku, is always saying that government is open to talks. The special advisor to the governor of Borno State, I'm talking of Issa Umar Gusau, when asked by the press to substantiate whether indeed the governor has spoken with Boko Haram, he evaded the question. But we do know that the governor himself, talking of Kashim Shettima, he has always been saying that he's ready to negotiate, he's ready to broker peace between federal government and Boko Haram. But again, let me state that there is no clear answer as to the federal government getting in touch with Boko Haram in these 24 hours.
What do Nigerians say about the claim?
A group of northern elders just ended a meeting in Kano and said that there has to be peace and there has to be amnesty granted to the sect members. But Nigerians are divided as to the kind of amnesty, because there are also calls that the group should be compensated. But Nigerians are saying, why should people who carry arms against their fellow men and country be rewarded for such a breakdown of law and order? Just listen to the opinions of Nigerians on this matter.
Amnesty can be granted without compensation. Then the victims should also be compensated so that there will be good forgiveness.
The goal of every Nigerian is to see an end to this crisis. What should also be emphasized more on is compensating the victims of these bombings, because they have families and relatives.
I don't think they should compensate them, because granting amnesty and compensating them will encourage more groups to emerge, just like the Niger Delta militants.
I was speaking to Ben Adam Shemang in Abuja.
Africa on the Move.
In Africa on the Move this week, we go to Kenya, where President Mwai Kibaki has launched a $10 billion project with the aim of branding Kenya as a global destination of choice for technology innovations. The president and his government plan to spend over $200 million in constructing Konza Technology City, known as the Silicon Savannah, a reference to the famous Silicon Valley in the United States. It's set to stand on 5,000 acres of land located about 60 kilometers east of Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Here is Alfred Kitty with more details.
Plans for Konza Technology City include a business process outsourcing park, science park, mega malls, convention center, data schools, world-class hotels, international schools, hospitals, a championship golf course, financial district, high-speed rail transport system, residential housing, among other high-class developments. International developers and investors have shown great interest in the new city, which is expected to brand Kenya as a global destination of choice for technology innovations. The $10 billion project should create over 20,000 direct jobs by the end of the year. The government of Kenya will spend an initial $210 million on the construction of basic infrastructure. Speaking at the groundbreaking ceremony, President Mwai Kibaki said,
"The government will facilitate the construction of both on-site and off-site infrastructure. This will include roads, water and sewerage systems, energy and high-speed rail, in order to make the city more attractive."
A New York-based firm, Shop Architects, was involved in the design of Konza City. Todd Sigaty is the company's events director.
"It's a city that's integrated. It's not just a tech park. And it's integrated with four different types of programs that activate each other. It's sustainable, it's walking, it's livable. It's where you work and live, not just commute to."
The brainchild of the entire project is Permanent Secretary in the Ministry of Information and Communication, Dr. Bitage Ndemo.
"Initially, we had assumed we would begin with business process outsourcing. But since we started the project, and in consultation with many consultants, we have expanded to include all the six flagship projects that are under Vision 2030. We've been working on that to ensure that we create the international financial center in this place."
A convention center park will be constructed first so that people can hold meetings straight away. Vice President Kalonzo Musyoka says several multinational companies have shown interest in establishing their headquarters in Konza City.
Companies like Boeing, Federal Express have already spoken to Dr. Demo and have actually said they are ready to come to Konza and be able to make this a headquarters of their Africa operations.
There are, however, fears that the new development will largely benefit foreigners at the expense of locals who have donated their land for construction of the project. Peter Kilonzo is a resident of neighboring Machakos district. According to me, I see more problems being brought to our people. Life will be very expensive, and those who are going to benefit from the luxuries are the foreigners who come with a lot of
money.
This kind of comment can also be found in internet forums, which have sprung up to debate whether Kenya really needs a project of this size.
Alfred Kitty with Silk on Savannah in Nairobi. Liberia's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is busy helping the United Nations to host a high-level summit on Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. MDGs are 8 international development goals officially set by the UN member states and some international organizations following the Millennium Summit happened 12 years ago. To avoid surprises, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has called a 4-day meeting to assess the goals and come up with suggestions on the global development agenda beyond 2015. Among others, British Prime Minister David Cameron and President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono of Indonesia are participating in the summit. I have been talking to our correspondent Julius Kanuba, who is in Monrovia, to find out what tops the agenda.
Where the fight against global poverty and ensuring or promoting sustainable development is at the core of the meeting in Monrovia. Basically, the UN high-level panel co-chairs are meeting to discuss and formulate development policies to tackle human sufferings after the target date of the MDGs shall have elapsed in 2015.
What are the challenges facing the MDG campaign?
Well, the challenges are very diverse. The issue of extreme hunger and poverty, and the issue of achieving the universal primary education. Many persons have spoken of a lack of access to education by women, and the issue about reducing child mortality, the issue of ensuring environmental sustainability. Generally, people tend to say that resource constraint is a key factor that has been challenging the full achievement of the Millennium Development Goals.
Turning to the host country, Liberia, do people really know what Millennium Development Goals are?
It depends on who really you ask, but to some extent, people in the capital, Monrovia, have knowledge on the Millennium Development Goals, as you will hear in this random sample.
The Millennium Development Goals, what I know about it is encapsulates a lot of things, particularly about the welfare of people, emphasizing the quality of life that should be lived.
It's intended to reasonably reduce poverty and increase development in and out of the urban era.
We've been following it closely since the adoption in 2000. As well, there is this issue of gender equality. There's whole discussion around gender issues. Before, there wasn't any discussion surrounding gender issues.
What I know is the Millennium Development Goal is very important for this country. A post-war country like Liberia, we find poverty, you know, we live below $2 a day and so on.
In 2012, President Sirleaf said MDGs have been successful in building a shared understanding of how to effectively address key dimensions of extreme poverty in Liberia. Has anything changed noticeably in Liberian society since the campaign started 12 years ago?
Well, things have changed to some degree, but poverty remains widespread in Liberia. A vast majority of Liberians remain in abject poverty.
Julius Kanuba speaking from Monrovia, Liberia.
Making a difference.
Now, it's not that often that we hear a disabled person is about to hold a top position in our government in Africa. Although in many job advertisements, disabled people are encouraged to apply. Not many of them make it to the top. Well, Ghana is about to show us a different side of the story. A visually impaired lawyer has been nominated to become the country's Minister for Chieftaincy and Traditional Affairs. And here is our correspondent in Accra, Isaac Kalezi, to tell us how Dr. Henry Seydou Dana made it to the top despite all the hurdles he had to overcome.
Dr. Dana welcomed me to his office. He looked excited about his appointment. He began by telling me how he lost his sight.
I was born 1955. I lost my eyesight when I was 7 years old due to measles. I got admission to the World School for the Blind, and by 1970 got a distinction and got to the Wenchi Sunday School, where I got my O-levels. I attended Legon 1st January 1979 to June 1981, and I got LLB, that's a degree in law. From where I proceeded to the London School of Economics, where I did a one-year master's. It was in 1986 that I got back to London, and during that time I was able to get a PhD in law.
Dr. Dana specializes in legal anthropology in the area of traditional African institutions and customary laws, especially in chieftaincy. This would be challenging for anyone, but Dr. Dana has also had to deal with the stigma attached to being disabled.
It was challenging. Let us not sometimes look at the difficult side. Otherwise, you will be deterred. But there is always light at the end of the tunnel. It was difficult, but the important thing is that I did it.
And what was the inspiration? What was keeping you going?
All along, I've believed that disability is not a barrier. And most of the time, people meet somebody who is disabled. Even without giving the opportunity to prove your worth, they start with the assumption that you cannot do it, which is wrong. When I was called to the bar at the law school, I was the first to be admitted, and all eyes were on me to see whether the man could do it. When I set that record, others followed, and today I think there are several other blind people who are members of the bar.
He was the first blind man to be called to Ghana's bar, and now becomes the first visually impaired person to be appointed a minister. Ghana's new Minister Designate for Chieftaincy and Traditional Affairs, Dr. Henry Seydou Dana, is promising to wage a campaign against chieftaincy disputes in Ghana if he gets the nod from Parliament.
To reduce the amount of disputes, we are going to look at the proceedings before the Traditional Council and then training of staff. I always say that you cannot have an effective administrative machinery in chieftaincy if you don't have efficient staff, because the chiefs are not supposed to go up in their clubs and smocks to do the work themselves. The main problem facing the institution right now is funding. And there again, it's a task that I think there's no runaway from. We will tackle it.
Before his appointment, Dr. Henry Seydou Dana was a driving force behind the research unit of the Chieftaincy Ministry. A staff member who worked closely with him, Adam Dennis, is full of praise.
He thrives on performance. He requires performance from you. That's inspired me a lot. It tells you that when you are doing something in your own corner somewhere and you do it so well, someone in the top position can identify you and want you to help to move the nation forward.
Once Dr. Dana is given the green light by Parliament, the next stage in his impressive career can begin. It is already clear that his story will serve as an inspiration to many other disabled persons to defy the odds and realize their dreams.
Such an inspiring story. Thank you, Isaac. Phew, that was an action-packed show, wasn't it? But before I leave these studios, here is a summary of what we have been covering. African and Western countries meeting in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa have pledged some €340 million in aid for Mali. Nigerian authorities on Tuesday welcomed a ceasefire declaration by a commander of Islamist sect Boko Haram, but security forces said they would not lower their guard. The Millennium Development Goals are under review in Liberia. And from Ghana, we have been hearing that a visually impaired lawyer has been nominated to become a minister. And that's how we end this edition of Africa Link. You have got views, comments or opinion about our program? Don't hesitate to drop us a line at feedback.africa@dw.de. You can also use our post address, which is Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. It's me, Assumpta Latus. Great to have had you around. See you tomorrow.